Hello, my name is Luke Clancy and this is the Culture File Weekly. Think of it as Culture File's big brother, with a week's worth of art, culture, making, doing and, of course, saying. This weekly, we're in Ballydehob, remembering the summer of love, or thereabouts, up the N71 for the heck of it to Cork City and on into the datafied dream world of 5G and the handmade world of Christopher Frayling. Precious little time to waste then. It's off to Ballydehob with you now. Bohemian and cosmopolitan West Cork was never more so than in 1968 when artists Krista Reichel and Nora Golden opened the Flower House on the main street of Ballydehob. The building became the birthplace of an extraordinarily infectious outbreak of ceramic batik, repoussé sculpture, painting and print. By the 1980s, it was said that you couldn't throw a stone in West Cork without hitting a potter. But who could resist the invitation? Now Brian Lawler, artist, writer and founder of the Ballydehob Arts Museum, is gathering the objects that tell the story of that time, which is something he also did for Culture File's Eleanor Flegg.
This is the former AIB Bank building in Ballydehob, and it never looked like that when it was a bank. It is now functioning as the tourist office, and it's being developed into the Ballydehob Arts Museum.
It's pink and purple and lime green.
Yes. There is no chance you're going to miss it.
At the present, the museum occupies that room, and there's an archive storage upstairs, which I'll show you.
Okay. How did Ballydehob come to be a centre for the arts?
I think chance had a lot to do with it. But the worldview of people coming out of art college in Ireland, in Britain, in the United States and in Germany, there was a lust for travel. And places that were, it was possible in which to settle and buy property very cheaply, obviously were a great attraction. And Ballydehob turned out to be one of those places. People came for different reasons. The German people who settled here were fleeing the nuclear holocaust, which was expected. And the idea was that the winds, Atlantic winds, were blowing in from the Atlantic onto Ireland, and therefore it was a place least likely to be unsafe. So, I mean, it does sound maybe a bit absurd now, but that was a significant thought at the time. Most of the young people who came here were products of art college, not all of them, but they learned skills, and then what are you going to do? They needed somewhere to set up where you could have a house and you could have sheds. You needed space to make what you wanted to make. Here it was all possible, but there was no grand plan. It happened by increments. The most significant person, individual, was Krista Reichel, and she and her partner, Nora Golden, who was a batik artist, workers over there, set up a pottery and art studio in a, not an abandoned farmhouse, but a semi-derelict farmhouse. They eventually bought a building on the main street of Ballydehob called the Flower House, and they developed that as a craft outlet for the work that they were making. And that proved successful. It went from being a chance operation into something that became quite professional. And out of that developed the Cork Craftsmen's Guild, which was from the 70s to the 80s, the largest craft organization in the country, driven from Ballydehob. Can I show you something? Do you see this photograph here? This is the Flower House on the main street of Ballydehob, based on what they were doing in Chelsea at the same time. A local shop painted up with these floral decorations covering the whole of the front of the building. And this was Nora Golden, Krista Reichel's partner.
It has a Sergeant Pepper flavour about it.
Absolutely. You've got the period to perfection. Huge yellow and pink flowers and purple blossoms of some kind, and the title, the artist's flower house. This then became a magnet for the area, because unlike having houses in the hills, this was so public. Nothing like it had ever been seen locally. Country towns were then very sober looking. They're much less sober now.
This is the storeroom. We're upstairs in the bank building, and there are shelves of treasures, each in a little cardboard box, neatly categorised and marked.
That's what I'm doing. I'm gathering in the material, identifying it, not always possible.
That's an elegant jug.
It is, yes. Well, a lot of these things are quite exciting in their own right. They became commonplaces, but I think that we can, you know, we can develop the story of Ballydehob and the wider locality from this material. These are quite curious, different types of work by Leda May. Some, you know, I'm not sure that these work particularly well. They're mugs, I suppose, goblets. So, you know, we're not choosing just the most beautiful things that people produced, but representative of the range of their work.
Well, it's about telling the history through objects.
It is, yes.
Some of them are more fashionable than others.
Mm-hmm. Without any doubt. I mean, this is material culture, and we have to look at it in terms of what was done, rather than, you know, having a more limited blinkered view. So sometimes, you know, I get quite surprised by, I mean, this strange little object turned up. We don't know who it's by. It's probably local. We don't know what it's for.
It's a little lumpy thing with leaves on it.
That, I think, it describes it perfectly. But somebody will come along and say, oh, you know what that was used for? So we will then know. Somebody will know.
I'm so happy that you're not trying to establish an aesthetic standard.
No, definitely not. I'm very, very open to what comes to the museum. Afterwards, we can establish some kind of hierarchy of things that are exceptional. But the idea is to represent the period and the people and whatever they made, irrespective.
Brian Lawler at Ballydehob Arts Museum there with Eleanor Flegg. And there'll be two exhibitions at the museum this summer, the Irish Tea Ceremony, which looks at local teapots and allied artefacts, and then Ballydehob on Bahnhofstrasse, which revisits the antics of 12 West Cork artists and craftspeople who held an exhibition in Zurich in the 1980s. Next, does 5G feature a pause button? Shannon Mattern, Professor of Anthropology at New York's New School, specialises in media and design and has recently been studying the fog of words around 5G mobile internet technology and its promise of what Professor Mattern calls a datafied dream world. She spoke at TCD earlier this week, along with Linda Doyle, Professor of Engineering and the Arts, about why technologists might want to make time and space to broaden their thinking about the future. Desire is the big part of it. What is it that we want from 5G and how did we end up wanting that is some sort of a question.
I'm not sure that we really want the things that 5G is selling to us. Really, in many cases, it's driven by what technologists are able to make. And a lot of engineering, no offense to engineers, a lot of their work is kind of driven by what is possible technologically, essentially. And then in some cases, you, after the fact, develop a use case for it. And I'm not sure that this drive for better, bigger, faster is really always offering tangible benefits for the public in many cases. So I'm not sure that it's a universal desire to have all of the things that the marketing images are selling us. There are plenty of Communities, both large and small, who are raising concerns, asking questions, identifying potential risks, for instance. One of them is related to public health. Most of the folks, I would say the majority of people, regard the public health concerns as groundless fears. That said, there have been some credible publications who have issued essentially literature reviews of the existing research about millimeter waves, 5G technology, who've said that it would be best for us to have more research and research that is not influenced by telecom funding. That's the issue with a lot of the scientific health-based research about millimeter waves and most telecommunications potential impacts for public health, is that the research is often funded by the telecom companies themselves. So it's only natural, and I think probably a healthy degree of skepticism that leads people to prefer to have fewer vested interests involved in this research that is kind of making claims about what impact technology will have on their bodies.
You were talking in TCD to a group which featured a lot of engineers. How did they respond to your worries and your suggestion that a pause button might be installed?
Well, I was actually quite nervous about speaking to a lot of engineers because I typically speak to people who are, I guess, on my side of the more critical-oriented approach to technology. Although I do work with a lot of artists who work primarily with technology, but most of their artistic work is really offering a kind of a helpful critical framework. There's a lot of discussion kind of on a global scale about a lot of computer science, data science, engineering programs, really starting to think about what it would meaningfully mean to implement ethics and justice concerns. So not just considering what can the technology allow us to do, but to pause, again, to use that term, before you put it out in the world, to think about what are the possible intended, and then if we really dig, think and imaginatively, what are the potentially really negative unintended consequences of this thing if we roll it out into the world? There were a couple the engineering faculty who came up to me afterwards and said, like, what have we done wrong? Why does nobody understand what we're doing? I think they were hopefully not offended, but maybe a little bit disappointed to hear that in my review of what other folks are thinking and saying about 5G, that there is such what they regarded as paranoia, and they seem to think it was unfounded paranoia, rooted in part in that they just didn't understand how the technology worked. That was the one concern, a repeated concern, that granted, that I did hear from a few of the engineering faculty.
If computer scientists and engineers were to have a kind of an ethical approach, where would they get it from? Say, take in your own discipline the kind of ethical underpinnings of anthropology. Is there something useful there, or where would they find the tools they need to think that way?
Well, what some schools are doing, and I don't teach in an engineering school. As I said, I teach with a lot of kind of creative technologists and programmers. What I think is really helpful for them is to work with people whose disciplines have that. And this is not to say the technologists and engineers do not have their own form of criticality, of course. But we have seen in recent years many cases where we've had a lot of public blow-ups, essentially. And we've had companies like Facebook and different infrastructure companies essentially had to backtrack and realize that perhaps they should have been more circumspect in the way they have policed or regulated or monitored the activity in their services, for instance. So rather than having to reach that crisis point and then backtrack, maybe we need to implement into a lot of these technological training programs or university programs more meaningful considerations of historical examples of what can and can't go wrong, or the theoretical insights from philosophy of technology, science and technology studies, which is a huge and really rich discipline that has a lot to offer to practicing technologists and engineers. Actually, last night in the discussion after my presentation, Linda had mentioned that in her engineering training, there was one kind of critical historicizing class that they took that they called pejoratively the talkie class, where it felt like just essentially shooting the breeze, essentially thinking kind of speculatively about what they're doing, that they didn't really see the utility of it until they actually got into practice years later. And maybe even after some mistakes were made in their practice, when they realized, maybe I should have taken more seriously that talkie class. Maybe it was actually much more meaningful, that is, than how it seemed to me when I was 18 or 19 years old.
Professor Shannon Matten there, Professor of Anthropology at the New School for Social Research, New York, at TCD's Connect Research Center in Dublin this week. Another take on what lessons are worth learning next this weekly with writer and critic and former head of the Royal College of Art, Professor Christopher Frayling. Craftsmanship and handmade objects often have been associated with a nostalgic backward glance towards an unspecified time when things were just better. But Kraft says Christopher Frayling is not really for the endangered species list. Kraft is alive and well and simply desperately in search of a new vocabulary for a new world, as Christopher Frayling told Culture File's Eleanor Flegg.
You've described craftsmanship as a word to start an argument with, so I wondered if we could have a little fight.
Well, there's a big argument going on in the fine art world. What about artists who produce this conceptual work and get someone else to make it for them? What's that about? And isn't it more interesting if the artist can actually make his or her own work? That's one argument. Another argument in the world of philosophy is sort of digital versus analog. You know, in this world of screens and digital technology, what about real things? What about actually doing things? What does that mean in a digital virtual world? So there's an argument going on about that. There's arguments in education about the importance of making in addition to the three R's. So at virtually all levels of life where visual studies are concerned, there's a debate at the moment about craftsmanship. I mean, I'm beginning to wonder whether the word craftsmanship hasn't outlived its usefulness. It's one of those moments, like in science, where you get a huge sort of paradigm shift where the arguments don't work anymore and what you need is a whole new vocabulary to describe it. So I'm beginning to use the word workmanship, which I find a little bit less baggage attached to it. I think workmanship has a huge place in the modern world at all sorts of levels. At a sort of spiritual level, the importance of making things. I mean, as human beings, one of the things that distinguishes us from animals is that we like doing things well, we do things for their own sake, and we like play, we like using our hands, mental manual coordination. So that's very deep. And I don't know what happens if we lose that. So that's at a sort of very broad level. You know, William Morris in the late 19th century was shouting about the importance of the crafts because of industrialization. I think you can double that with the importance of the crafts at a time of the third industrial revolution, the technological revolution which we're going through at the moment.
You mentioned the three R's, and I think that's a concept that's evolved historically.
With the help of some research students at the Royal College, I've been digging a bit about the origins of that phrase, the three R's. And the first thing we found in the 18th century was the Lord Mayor of London giving a speech about education, where he talked about the three R's, reading and writing, number one, arithmetic or reckoning, numeracy, number two, and wroughting or writing, W-R-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, as in shipwriting, wheelwriting, etc., making. So we dug a little further and found this stained glass window near Exeter in the West Country of England, which actually embodied in the stained glass window is this triangle, reading and writing, reckoning and making, wroughting. So when did it change? When did wroughting go out of the picture? When did making get lost from this triangle? And I think it was roughly in the mid-19th century, in the era of Mr. Gradgrind and Hard Times and Industrial Revolution and all those things, where the Victorians weren't awfully into wroughting, so the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and there it stayed ever since. I believe passionately that in primary and secondary education, the basis of a well-rounded education is learning how to read, learning how to write, learning how to count, and learning how to make, having a relationship with materials. One of the paradoxes of the crafts is there's this whole world of craftsmanship outside art schools, of, you know, dry stone walling, basket making, which are still alive in rural areas in Ireland and in England. But talking about art schools for a moment, within art schools from the 1970s, the crafts developed what I call this Cinderella complex, which is they didn't want to be in the kitchen anymore, they all wanted to go to the ball. And so they wanted to become artist craftspeople, studio potters, and be very arty. Fine. But in the process, what tended to happen educationally is they lost the grammar, they lost the deep technique that a craftsperson needs in order to sustain an existence. They wanted to fly before they could walk. They wanted to speak the language before they knew its grammar. And what's happened in art schools all over Western Europe and in America is that the basic making skills have been downgraded or shunted onto technicians, if you're lucky enough to have any. But the actual students want to fly from day one. And it's fine for the superstars who make it in galleries and can make a living out of this, but what about the other 98%? When they leave, they've got nothing. They haven't got a survival pack on their back. what they've got is an aspiration to be artists. And it worries me. It worries me a bit that it's actually very noble to be in the kitchen. You know, the great thing about Cinderella is, I mean, wouldn't it be nice to have a decently designed casserole? Or, I don't know, all sorts of kitchen utensils that are marvellous. You can't all go to the ball. The ball gets too crowded. And actually, it's not worth going to if too many people go to it. A man I rate very highly who... he's rather unfashionable at the moment. His name's Herbert Read, and he wrote about a book called Education Through Art in 1944. Little book, very, very important, I think. And in it, he made the distinction between teaching to art and teaching through art. Teaching to art is teaching the techniques of being an artist. Teaching through art is all the things that learning art seems to do very well. Solving your own problems, flexible thinking, creativity, getting used to a world where the goalposts keep shifting, finding your own voice, being original, all sorts of things which art seems to be very good at teaching. And he called that teaching through art. And I think there should be much more of an emphasis on teaching through art in art schools and slightly less emphasis on training to be superstars.
Professor Christopher Frayling there in conversation with Eleanor Flegg. Finally, on this week's Weekly, a little hike in Cork City, up 39 steps and down again into a cold basement underneath the terraced house where the songwriter Claire Sands has created a music studio. Little by little, she placed mattresses against stone walls, carpeted a concrete floor, put fiberglass on the ceiling. She made a warm place where she could write her songs and record her videos. She made an EP and called it, as is the tradition in music history, The Basement Sessions. For the track Let's Take the Time, she invited her friend, writer and playwright Conal Creedon to collaborate. Claire and Conal spoke to Rachel Andrews about their experience of working together, recording in a basement beneath Cork.
Oh,
yeah, this is...
wow.
Supposedly, this was... the house is 200 years old, and this was the station master's house, and this was actually filled with cement. So everybody else in the terrace were the workers. And I think the landlord, actually, and the people that owned this house actually dug out this place. It was filled with rubble, and so, you know, it really has been a long time.
I like to have coffee and coffee roasters there in the corner, and I like to do the crossword and have a glass of wine in the corner house, and Conal is generally in either of those places. We just got chatting over the last year, and when I wrote the piece, I heard his voice. It was very odd.
A grandmother awaits her granddaughter's knock on the door. Now she sets the table just for two. The girl curls up by the fire. She watches the sparks dance in her grandmother's eyes, and there they sit, in a warm, comfortable silence into the night.
I moved into a house in the north side of the city, I think about 4 years ago, and there was this basement, and it was just storage, like it was a dungeon. People used to say it was the dungeon. And over time, I think I bought a drum kit, and it just sort of escalated, that I just hung up a few blankets, and then I was like, you know, but there was all fiberglass that needed to be covered up, and I just sort of tipped away at it. It wasn't like I set out for a week and just said, I'm going to convert this thing. I just sort of kept adding stuff. And then eventually I was like, oh, wow, this is actually a rehearsal space, you know?
Like, Cork doesn't have that many basements, as you know, right? Because it's the way the city is built. Down on the flat, it's on marshland. And on the hills, you know, when you're built into a hill, basements don't really happen, right? Whereas other cities do have basements, like Dublin has a lot of basements and stuff, right? So to have a house with a basement is sort of odd in Cork, right? But to have a basement that you must go up 39 steps to go down into it, that's pretty, you know, I always think it's a good table quiz, right?
It's been a pretty magical place for me to channel everything that I've learned from my travels and for a place to escape.
Because we got lost along the way. I want a world where I can hear the birds sing. Where
I always leave Ireland in January. I always find it very fruitful for writing because you don't have as many distractions as you do here. So that's where the track came about, was in Cuba, because obviously it's still a communist country and you only get the internet for like an hour a day, you know? And to queue up in a park, it's pretty bizarre. I get these cards and I tried nothing to do, only to sit and write stuff, you know?
The woman with eyes blue as wild Atlantic shores and skin golden as Ross Bay sands waits apprehensively at the gates. St. Peter.
I just sat there and watched all these families just spending time together, which is what we used to do, really, but technology's come along and stuff like that. With that track, it was, I think it was all the subliminal, subconscious stuff from my childhood, really, you know. Like the opening verse, I'm talking about fishing with my dad, which is something I haven't done in, you know, 15 years. So it is amazing when you just take a step back and leave, you know, your thoughts actually run free, you know.
The few times we've recorded it for different reasons, I've played it, when she starts playing the opening riff, I actually forget I have something to say, and this happens all the time, and she's doing it about three or four times, and I'm there listening, and I think, God, that's amazing, right? And then eventually I look over, she's going, are you going to do your bit? This happens, and in fact, in a few recordings, you just hear me saying, God, that's incredible.
Well, Lord, ways cruelty.
Sadly, Claire, you actually had to dismantle the basement studio very recently.
Yeah, literally 2 days ago. Yeah, we're getting thrown out. Such is life, such is the renting crisis, you know. Yeah, like, it broke my heart to do it, but, you know, at the same time, we've created something pretty beautiful, I think. Something I'm very happy with, which is very rare for me. Yeah, I think that was it for me, actually. It's time for the next adventure, wherever that is going to be.
Let's Take the Time by Claire Sands, featuring Conal Creedon there, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll have more underground sounds next Friday at 7 p.m. Until then, bye now.